It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up, we'll take a look at Governor Walker's financing proposal for a new arena in Milwaukee. First, obsessive-compulsive disorder is commonly misunderstood. When we think of the disorder, I might think of people who wash their hands a lot, have really tidy homes. Well, these can be some of the compulsions. The picture is a lot bigger. OCD is the fourth most common mental illness after depression, anxiety, and substance abuse. It affects about 1 in 40 adults in the U.S. It can occupy hours and hours of an affected person's day as they obsess and then act compulsively on their obsessions. David Adam is a writer and editor at Nature. He recently wrote a book about his own experience with OCD and chronicled what we know and don't know about the disorder. The book is The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, getting into how this manifests for you, you say, quoting, "I obsess about ways I could catch AIDS. I compulsively check to make sure I haven't caught HIV. I steer my behavior to make sure I don't catch it in the future. I see HIV everywhere." How has that affected your daily life, looking back?
It dominated it. I grew up in the 1980s when HIV and AIDS was the big spectre that everyone was told to be terrified of, and I was. And I started to become obsessed with ways that I might have caught it. Now, I wasn't having unsafe sex and I wasn't doing drugs, so all the ways that I worried about were those that we're all always told that you couldn't have caught it, like, I don't know, kissing people or scratching my hand on a fence. Because I always dreamt up really unlikely ways in which I could have caught it, like maybe someone else had left blood on that fence just at the exact spot where I had cut myself. And I knew these fears were ridiculous, but they were just completely dominant. And the only way I could find to try and address them was to try and reassure myself that I hadn't caught HIV. So this was the compulsive behavior, and that's what OCD is. It's a very strange, random, often very distressing thought which people know that they shouldn't have in a way, and yet you can't make it go away. And the only way you can find to make it go away is to perform some kind of compulsion. And you get, and in performing that compulsion, you make the thought more likely to return, and so you just live in this mental cycle for pretty much all of the time.
And you say whatever the obsession and the compulsion manifest as, a difference between someone with OCD, someone without, the person without it might say that's a one in a million chance and move on. And with OCD, that one in a million, whatever the obsession is, can't be dismissed.
Yeah, exactly. And so I will quite happily fly. I'll get on an aeroplane. I know the risk is not zero. I'll drive my car. I'll cross the road. I'll do all those things where there is probably a greater risk of me harming myself than catching HIV from a barbed wire fence. But it's completely irrational. It taps into something very deep and very old in the brain, probably. And it's just, it's my thing. That's why it's an obsession. And it can be anything. I mean, some people are irrationally frightened of just about anything you can think of. But we do know that HIV was a very common theme for OCD. So lots and lots of people, there'll be people listening to this right now whose jaws will be dropping open saying, oh my goodness, he's describing my life. I thought I was the only one, because after every interview I do like this, I get emails from people saying, oh my goodness, I thought it was just me.
Now, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, I think it's probably one of those things that most of us think we know what it is. There's a pop culture version and then a real version. What do most of us who haven't experienced it ourselves get wrong about OCD?
I think most people have obsessions, obsessive thoughts. You know, you find you can't stop thinking about something. And some people have compulsive habits. So, you know, they might need to tap the wall three times when they walk past it or something like that. And so everybody has an insight into what it's like. But the way I describe it is they have the O and the C, but they don't have the D. Mm. And the D is the disorder. And it's when you take those to the degree that it interferes with your life, and really interferes with your life.
I think at one point you used the word anchor. It's an anchor that weighs you down. How much of your time and energy when you're living with OCD does it absorb?
All of it. I mean, it sounds crazy, and I feel better now as much as I can. And even I find it hard to accept just how much of my life this dominated. But it's, if you say to someone, you know, don't think of something, if I said, you know, don't think of an elephant, then of course, what do you think of? And we're very used to having control of our thoughts and us being in charge. And so when you have a thought which you can't make go away, it's very, very alien and very distressing and omnipresent. It's just the only way I could make it go away was basically by distracting myself. So I was, you know, I played a lot of sport. I love skiing. And weirdly, I like doing stuff like this, live radio interviews that most people would run a mile from. But I quite like it because it concentrates my mind. And for 10 or 15 minutes, what I'm not thinking about is HIV.
Now, what, you're a science writer, in addition to someone dealing with OCD, what do we know about what causes obsessive-compulsive disorder?
So it depends who you ask. If you ask a psychologist, they'll tell you it's down to psychology. If you ask a neuroscientist, they'll tell you it's neuroscience and then the brain. The honest answer is we don't really know. We know certain things like it seems to run in families, which suggests that there's probably a genetic component. But it's not an easily found one because people have looked. We know that the brains of people with OCD seem to work differently under certain circumstances. But again, we don't know really enough about what those parts of the brain do to start attributing cause to it. The easiest way to explain it is in terms of psychology. And what's very important to realize is that the kind of thoughts that get stuck in OCD are really common, and almost everybody has them. So that's the thought, for example, people driving their car and they get a strange urge to steer off the road, or they're waiting for a train and they get a strange urge to jump in front of the train when it arrives, or they're in somewhere really quiet, like a library or a church, and they get an urge to shout something really vulgar. Those are really common. Those are called intrusive thoughts. And in most people, they go away. And so the question is, what is it that makes them stick around in OCD? And there are a couple of sort of psychological makeups, if you like, that seem to make them more likely to stick around. And one of those is what's called having an inflated sense of responsibility. So some people are more likely than others to feel particularly personally responsible for a certain situation, and usually to prevent harm. So, for example, the person who might get the urge to steer their car off the road, if they had a heightened sense of this kind of responsibility, they might think, well, maybe I am a risk, maybe I should take more care. And so maybe they'll slow down a bit, or maybe they'll grip the steering wheel a little bit more tightly. And in doing that, they give the thought significance, and so the thought becomes more likely to stick around, so they then need to perform the compulsion again. And in this way, it escalates to the point where some people just won't drive because they fear this, and they fear doing something which would have consequences. And so that is the kind of mindset, if you like, the kind of thinking patterns, which do seem to possibly explain why almost everybody has these weird thoughts, but not everybody has OCD.
So the causes of OCD, big question mark, it sounds like. What is out there in the world of treatment? Anything looking promising?
Well, there is a treatment, and I think it's the same over there with you guys that it is over here. You get a combination of things. You get a high dose of antidepressant drugs, the thing like Prozac. Not that we're depressed, but it just seems to work. It just seems to alleviate the symptoms, and they're not quite sure why. And then usually in tandem with that, you get a course of what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And as part of that, you learn the cognitive, you learn about the kind of psychology that we just described. And you also learn that everybody has these weird thoughts, which is really helpful when you start to think that you're the only person who does. And then the B, the behavioral therapy, is in OCD. Anyway, it's about exposing people to what they are anxious about, what they obsess about, but preventing them performing the compulsions, because when we perform the compulsive behavior, it's to relieve anxiety. So in the old days, they would actually, you know, someone might have a fear of germs and contamination, and they would make people sift through rubbish with their bare hands, sift through trash, and then they would actually tie their hands so they couldn't go and wash them. And then the principle is that once you stir this anxiety, if you keep it high by stopping them performing the compulsion, then it has to go down at some point, because physiologically we just can't maintain it on high alert for that amount of time. And so the theory is, once you as someone with OCD realize and learn that this anxiety will go down by itself, then in the future you don't need to perform the compulsions, and so you break that cycle that we talked about.
David, that sounds really traumatic to me.
It was. I mean, it is by definition. You know, you have to stir the anxiety, and then you're preventing them taking the easy way out, which is the only way out that they know. And it is very traumatic. And this is why lots of people find the treatment very difficult. Lots of people drop out. Lots of people, I mean, there's something like a 10-year lag usually between people being diagnosed with OCD and people going for treatment. But it does seem to work in most people, not everybody, and not everybody gets 100% better, but a significant amount of people improve.
David, and as we wrap up, 1 in 40 adults, if that number's right, we're all going to encounter someone with OCD, whether we know it or not. What do you wish everyone else knew that might help you as we meet you dealing with someone with OCD?
I think two things. The common misconception about OCD is just about hygiene and order. It is damaging to people with OCD because they think, well, what on earth is wrong with me? They don't recognize that they have OCD because they think OCD is all about hand washing, and they have these strange thoughts about hurting their children or whatever. And the second thing is just for everybody to be more honest about these really, really strange thoughts, because if I knew, you know, when I was 20 years old, that almost everybody had these really odd thoughts from time to time, which they couldn't, which they could make go away, but I couldn't, then I wouldn't have felt quite so isolated. And that's one of the great sort of ironies of OCD, is that you're very aware that you shouldn't be thinking this, and yet you can't stop it. And because the content of the thoughts is very often, you know, it's about violence, or it's about disease, or it's about sex, it can be quite difficult to bring those subjects up in conversation. And so if everybody was just more honest and open about these really odd thoughts, then people would be more willing to talk about them when they really cause them difficulty.
David, thanks a lot for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with David Adam, writer and editor at Nature, talking about his new book, The Man Who Couldn't Stop OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. Governor Walker announced his support this morning for a financing plan that would bring a new multi-purpose arena to Milwaukee. It would serve as a new home for the Milwaukee Bucks, among other things. Walker's proposing what's been known as a jock tax on athletes to cover about $220 million in financing. He called it a Bucks Pay Their Own Way plan. It'll be in his budget proposal next week. Not everyone is on board with the idea so far. Joining us now to break down that proposal is Don Walker. He's a reporter of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's been following this ongoing saga. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So this idea, a jock tax to cover $220 million for the new Bucks arena, multi-purpose arena, what is that? How would it work?
Well, it's relatively simple. Like anyone who lives outside this state and then comes here to work in some fashion, they pay income taxes, and that's no different for a visiting NBA professional athlete, as well as the Milwaukee Bucks players themselves. So they've been paying income taxes for a number of years, obviously. The idea that the governor is having is, we know how much money that is generated right now. It's approximately $6.2 million a year. What the governor is proposing is, because the NBA in recent months signed incredibly lucrative television contracts with at least two partners, ESPN and TNT, the expectation is that teams will be getting millions more in dollars in revenue, and of course that will trickle down to the players. If you're going to pay the players more money, they're obviously going to be paying more in income tax. So with that in mind, a number of people work together, according to the governor, Goldman Sachs, the Bucks, the NBA, and Governor Walker's own finance people, and came up with a calculation that sort of tracked the increase in this income tax revenue over X number of years. And it's that extra revenue that the governor is proposing be captured that would be used to pay the debt service on $220 million worth of debt, or excuse me, of bonds that would be applied toward the construction of the new arena.
So the state bonds up front, this $220 million, there's no new increased tax rate, no additional assessment. The idea is that the $220 million gets paid off with the hypothetical increased salaries of the NBA players.
That's correct, and anticipating perhaps a question you might have, when would this end? And that's not entirely clear. Obviously, if this goes through the legislature and is signed into law by the governor, there would be some lease terms, I presume, would be implemented in the agreement, and the Bucks would have to abide by that. I should also mention that the governor put a provision in his proposal that I think helps also protect the taxpayer, and that is this. Should the current owners of the Milwaukee Bucks sell the team, say, 10 years down the road, they would be on the hook to pay off that debt service that's left before they could sell the team to the new owner. I should say the new owner would probably have to pay that amount.
Is this something that you think will be more palatable to residents, to legislators, than a regional sales tax increase or other things that have been done in the past?
Well, I do think it is a little bit more saleable than perhaps an increase in the sales tax. So from that standpoint, yes. However, as this has sort of unfolded through the afternoon, you're beginning to get some pushback from some legislators, and recently within the hour, Americans for Prosperity, obviously a well-known conservative group that would be inclined to back Governor Walker in many initiatives, has come out against the proposal, saying the business, or I should say the government, should not be in the business of subsidizing arenas and stadiums. That is a common complaint among libertarian organizations and conservative groups, that professional sports franchises should not get any help from a government.
Right. They're saying this amounts to public financing, even if hypothetically it would be paid back.
That's correct.
The other opposition has been along the lines in Milwaukee itself of, don't put public support into this. We have more pressing needs, parks, schools, playgrounds, things like that around Milwaukee. What's been the response from people who've been making those arguments so far?
Well, we haven't heard anything yet today, but I anticipate later this week. The group Common Ground is a well-known community organization in Milwaukee, and a very effective one, I might say. They have been on, on record in opposition to any form of public financing for the arena. They believe that if they are willing, they are willing to support public financing as long as tens of millions of dollars are set aside to improve recreational and school facilities in Milwaukee County. At this juncture, they have not been able to convince anyone otherwise, but I think you will start to see that kind of opposition grow in the weeks and months to come.
The big question whenever there's talk of public financing of this or any other sports facility is, what's the economic payoff for the city, for the region? What's the state of the art of the argument of that when it comes to this particular project?
Well, it's funny. There are a few things that economists agree upon, and especially sports economists, but there have been plenty of studies done in the last 10 or 15 years, and they're almost all conclude the same thing, that new sports facilities, either stadiums or arenas, do not necessarily generate new economic development in a community. Having said that, arenas have a slightly better chance of creating new economic activity, if only because they get used more often than, say, a football stadium like Lambeau Field.
And what other kinds of activities are we talking about here proposed in this complex?
Well, I suspect that, and I have spoken with the Bucks owners, among other things, besides Milwaukee Bucks basketball, Marquette men's basketball, Milwaukee Admirals hockey, concerts, and so on. They have designs on a new arena in which they would be able to sort of reformat the Arena Bowl in such a way that even smaller concerts could be held, say 3,000-4,000 people, as opposed to say 16,000. That, I suspect, if it's successful, would be able to produce additional revenue for the team.
Don, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You're welcome.
That's Don Walker with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to discuss Governor Walker's proposal for funding a new arena in Milwaukee for the Milwaukee Bucks and other activities. Enbridge Energy is expanding its Line 61 oil pipeline running from Superior to the Illinois border. The Canadian firm has begun building 8 out of 9 pump stations along the route as part of plans to send up to 1.2 million barrels per day across the state. As Danielle Kading reports, a Dane County committee will meet this evening to consider a permit for the final pump station, which has been met with some opposition.
Peter Anderson is walking the proposed site of Dane County's Enbridge Pump Station. The spokesman for environmental group Madison 350 has voiced concerns about the project to the County Zoning and Land Regulation Committee. Anderson says the company should provide insurance if they want the committee to grant a permit for construction.
We see a wetland, and then if you look south of here, there's the Menasha River. That's the area we want to make sure is protected if this line spills. They say they'll build a berm over where that property line is to hold about 1 hour's worth of flow. But in the case of the Kalamazoo accident, it ran for 17 hours.
In 2010, around 843,000 gallons of heavy crude spilled from an Enbridge pipeline into Michigan's Kalamazoo River, costing around $1.2 billion to clean up. The Dane County Land and Zoning Committee has been reviewing a permit for an Enbridge pump station as part of the pipeline expansion. The committee postponed action several times since last fall after people raised concerns about its impact on the environment. Zoning Committee Chair Patrick Miles says the Federal Pipeline Safety Act limits how they can address some concerns. He says requiring insurance may be one of the few options they can explore.
There's a concern raised by many that if there's to be a conditional use permit granted, that there needs to be some assurance that if there's an accident, there are resources available to cover the cost of cleanup of a potential spill.
Enbridge says it has up to $700 million in general liability insurance and access to up to $1 billion through the Federal Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. The Canadian firm has also agreed to provide a spill basin similar to those at its Superior terminal. At the Superior facility, Enbridge Energy spokeswoman Becky Hazy stands near 2 containment ponds that prevent any spills into the Nemadji River, which empties into Lake Superior. Hazy says they've invested $4.4 billion over the past 2 years on inspections, new technologies, staff, and training to improve pipeline safety since the Kalamazoo River spill. She says requiring additional insurance is unnecessary.
In the unlikely event that something happens there, we're going to clean it up. Insurance, no insurance. If something happens, we're responsible and we foot the bill to clean it up.
Wisconsin DNR spills coordinator Jason Lowry says the company has reported 9 spills in the last 10 years.
The vast majority of them haven't resulted in any known documented long-term contamination. They were cleaned up fairly quickly.
With the exception of a 2007 incident that spilled around 200,000 gallons of oil in Rusk County, causing groundwater contamination there, according to Lowry. He says the company has taken steps to clean the site and drinking water wells were not affected. Lowry says spills are going to happen. Enbridge's Hazy says opponents should recognize the number is small compared to the amount of oil they transport.
It's not even a handful of incidents that they can refer to. We transport millions of barrels of oil every day.
Zoning Committee Chair Patrick Miles says they'll discuss at a meeting tonight whether to require coverage from Enbridge, and if so, what kind. Enbridge attorneys argue federal law prevents this kind of local zoning restriction. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Danielle Kading in Superior.
Winter continues, really not a bad one here in Wisconsin as these things go so far. Heavy right now in the northeastern part of the country, and sure, lots of people talk about how we need to embrace winter. Get out, have fun, all that stuff. Sometimes, though, we just need to build a nest and read a great book. That's where you come in. Call in now with your suggestion for a great winter read, something you can really, I don't know why I keep coming back to this phrase, hunker down with. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Heard from a lot of our WPR colleagues. John Munson up in Superior, he knows what winter is. He recommends Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. He says it's always good for a laugh to help chase away the winter blues. Well, how about you? 800-642-1234. Mark is on the line to start us off up in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, I actually read two books over the holidays. I read a book called Wicked Plants by Amy Stewart. It's a very quick read. You can easily read it in a day or a half a day. But it's about poisonous and toxic plants, and there were some surprises on that book. But the one that I really wanted to talk about was a book called The Martian. It's a new book. It's about an astronaut that gets marooned on Mars and the things he does to survive. And if you're an engineer, you'll love the book. It's great.
I've heard of that one. I have not read it, but it keeps coming up, so that's what I'll have to definitely check out. Mark, thank you. Are you an engineer yourself, Mark?
Yes, and it was given to me as a Christmas gift by an engineer as well.
All right. Well, I'll have to check it out, though I'm not an engineer, nor should I be. I think bad things would happen. Thanks a lot for that, Mark. We'll go now to Joe in Port Washington. Joe, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your winter read?
I would highly recommend the Lord of the Rings books. I know that, you know, a lot of people know about them, but the stories they're just incredible, and they're fantastic reads, and in my opinion, they're a lot better than the movies. And as far as hunkering down and grabbing a cup of tea and a good book, I can't recommend anything better.
That'll keep you going for a while, and is that worth a regular rereading to you?
I would say so. I read all four back in high school. I'm 37 now, and I definitely would consider pulling them out again after I'm done reading the other pile of books I have at home, so...
Wonderful, Joe. Thanks a lot for that suggestion. Staying on fantasy, our own Rick Ryer says, The Wise Man's Fear by Patrick Rothfuss. Lose yourself, he says, in the fantasy world of a notorious magician, an accomplished thief, a masterful musician, and an infamous assassin. We're waiting for book three. Patrick Rothfuss is a Wisconsin author, Eau Claire area. If you're listening, Patrick, you know, we're all waiting. But, you know, no rush. Back to our callers. Thanks, Joe. We'll go to Michael in La Crosse. Michael, hi.
Hi. My recommendation would be The Lucana by Barbara Kingsolver. A lot of people know her from the Poisonwood Bible, but this is a novel that starts off in Mexico, so it's warm, and then it ends up here in the States.
It's okay. And she's a big name. A lot of people have read her other books. And what's the name of this series, Michael?
I'll spell it. It's L-U-C-A-N-A, Lucana, as in like when they... when there's a missing section in a text.
Oh, okay. All right, great. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for that suggestion. We are taking your winter reading suggestions, a book that you can just really settle in with when you want to ignore the weather. 800-642-1234 or post in the Central Time Facebook page. Laura is with us next in Toma. Laura, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your recommendation?
It's a book by a Wisconsin author, and it's called The Story of Edgar Sawtelle.
Okay.
And it takes place up in the North Woods. It's about a boy who is mute and who raises a new breed of dogs. And the first 30 pages are kind of tough to get through, but once you get through there, you can't put it down.
Fantastic. And another Wisconsin one, Laura. Thanks for that. One I wanted to mention from our own Susanna Michaels, In the Land of White Death by Valerian Albanov, a true first-person story about getting stuck in sea ice near the North Pole. Bad things happen. She says, why would you read this book in the winter? Because as bad as our winter is, it's not nearly as bad as being stuck in sea ice for a full year. So I guess that'll make us feel a little better. Jim is with us now on the phone in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Good. How's it going?
Good. What's your recommendation?
It's a book I bought years ago. It's called Marine Sniper, 93 confirmed kills, kind of pigeonholes with the American Sniper.
I was going to say, yeah.
Movie. And it's a story of a Marine named Carlos Hathcock during the Vietnam War who was just amazing at what he was able to accomplish. And it's one of them you can't put down.
All right, so that definitely occupies your mind as you're reading it in the winter. Thank you so much, Jim. Molly, next with us in Superior. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Rob.
Hi. What's your recommendation?
I would recommend anything by Sarah Madison Allen. She's out of North Carolina, and all of her books just kind of have a little, they bring out the magic in everyday life, which I think is really fun.
All right. Thank you so much, Sarah Addison Allen. Well, thank you. And thanks for all of your suggestions. You can keep them coming on the Central Time Facebook page. A few more that callers who are on the phone don't have time to get to them, but the books The Life of Teddy Roosevelt, Gone with the Wind, oh, and Ready Player One. And I read somewhere there's a sequel coming out to that, a fiction. It's basically a nerd fantasy for those of us who grew up as nerds in the 1980s. Well, thanks so much for those calls. And I'll try to get a list of a lot of what we talked about up on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about a new kind of sports center in the works here in Wisconsin called the Ability Center. It's a health and fitness facility that would be designed specifically for people with disabilities. The blueprints for the Ability Center include a track, a fitness center, climbing wall, several pools and volleyball courts, and 6 basketball courts. Sports Facilities Advisory, a sports facilities planning and management group, just did an economic feasibility study on the Ability Center, gave it a green light that takes it one step closer to being a reality. We have Damian Bookman with us. He's the founder and executive director of the Ability Center. Damian, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Also with us, Jason Clement. He's the founder and COO of the Sports Facility Advisory and Sports Facility Management. Jason, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be with you.
Let's start with you, Damian. What inspired you to pursue making this Ability Center a reality?
A handful of things, really. Primarily, I myself have an ambulatory disability from childhood cancer in both of my legs, and after having 22 knee replacements and revisions, pursuing my athletic goals, dreams, hopes kind of became nearly impossible without access to opportunities such as the Ability Center. And I also used to run a sports facility in Waukesha, Wisconsin, where in my nearly 10 years there, we only served one time a year, people with developmental disabilities through the Special Olympics, and I've always felt that people impacted by disabilities deserved more.
And this is in the works for Milwaukee, right?
Yeah, the Milwaukee County area in southeastern Wisconsin, but with an ultimate goal of duplicating it in some level, in some manner throughout the country.
So what kind of features would the Ability Center have that would make it a friendly place for athletes with disabilities?
This is really about designing a space that's universal, not necessarily ADA code of law accessible, but what we call code of people accessible by doing universal design and the use of universal design. So whether that's more space, be it in the locker rooms or on the courts, or access to accessible equipment, both athletic and fitness-wise, or even including fitness classes that are adapted to individuals with various disabilities, it would offer a space that brings value to your membership and value to your time when you would enter the Ability Center.
And Damian, what do you see as the need, the interest in a facility like this?
Well, you know, in Milwaukee County alone, there's roughly 100,000 people that report a disability. In a 7-county area in Wisconsin, in southeastern Wisconsin here, there's roughly 190,000. So the need is pretty significant. And of these individuals, both families raising a child with an with a disability or individuals with disability, 25 to 50% are living at or below poverty level. So they have a need for access to a space that's affordable, inclusive to their needs.
Now, Jason Clement, let's bring you in on this. You did this economic feasibility study on the Ability Center. What makes this kind of idea a viable economic option for the community?
That's right, we did. Well, first of all, we look at the benefits to these types of complexes, both from a qualitative and quantitative perspective. The community benefit to these types of facilities and operations are vast. Team building, character development, these types of operations bring families together. Most of us are not professional athletes, but we can attribute some sort of our character development to playing or participating in a sport while growing up. today, sports being utilized as a tool to facilitate mental, athletic, social, and spiritual growth in a diverse number of venues. And what's unique about the model for the Ability Center is that it's bringing the virtues of sport to a community that has very limited access. With that comes an opportunity to open up additional funding for it. And because of the lack of access for this particular community, we think that it's going to be utilized in very significant ways. And so when you quantify the economic impact, we're talking about over $15 million in economic impact, including over $7 million in sales tax revenue generated over the first 5 years. We're talking about 39 direct jobs, 242 indirect jobs created. And just during the one-time construction period, we're talking about a $54 million economic impact that can be attributed to just building this one complex, much less the rollout of this model that Damian was referring to across the country.
And Jason, since we don't have these things across the country, is there a prospect for sports tourism?
There absolutely is. And one of the great things about the design of this particular model is that it's not just for people with disabilities. It also has the flexibility to integrate both the able-bodied and the disabled for programming. So it will cater to disabled sports tourism, which is a big market, over a $200 billion market across the country, where many of the disabled don't have an opportunity to go play and compete in tournaments and events, certainly at the regional level. So this will attract those types of events, certainly carve into that $200 billion industry to bring people into the Milwaukee County, into the area. Certainly hotel lodging will be impacted, retail, community spending, food and beverage, and those sorts of things.
A listener named John from Windsor was wondering if this is, in effect, segregating people with disabilities even maybe a little further than already. Shouldn't the focus maybe be on making existing athletic facilities more able to serve all communities? Damian, let's get your take on that.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment and a great question. You know, my response to that is I believe that institutions that are currently out there and available have been being asked to do that for the last two, three, four decades without adequate answer. And our thought is that if you can make a place where we have kind of called reverse inclusion, a place where it's made for people with disabilities and inclusive of the able-bodied public, it makes for a place where you feel more welcome, wanted, and comfortable. And I think that that's the most important things when you come through the doors of any facility, be it a sports facility, be it a movie theater, be it a mall, a local mall, that you feel like you're welcome and wanted here and not in the way. And I think it starts there. And for us, it's the goal is to actually get to a point where we can Ability Center certify locations where they can better understand how to serve people in their community with disabilities. And I think when you answer it with a space like this where research can be conducted in order to make sure that we're providing proper services, I think that that gives a model for them to aspire off of. Right now, if you walk into most fitness, you will hear that approximately 1% to 5% of the equipment in that space is accessible. The Ability Center is looking to include 56% accessible strength equipment with 31% accessible cardio equipment. So it's a pretty significant leap from what's currently out there to what we're envisioning.
Jason, are you seeing other communities around the country toying with this idea, or are we out in front here in Wisconsin on this?
Well, this is certainly a unique model. That said, we are seeing other facilities around the country taking a deeper look at this. And the reason is, nationally, as we look at the trends, a larger percentage of our population has some sort of disability. And a big contributor to that is our servicemen and women coming back from the wars and the altercations overseas. So many of the communities are looking to ways to incorporate and integrate that population into their existing complexes. That said, what Damian has hatched here with his board is certainly unique, and his leadership, his passion, charisma, and not to mention his history of beating that life-threatening cancer just make him a great catalyst and a true differentiator for this type of model. And certainly with this first one, we anticipate this rolling out more regularly, whether they're standalone Ability Centers like this or whether existing facilities start to integrate more services that can
can serve that population.
And Damien, I wanted to ask you about that, veterans with disabilities.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, we've really thought, we certainly don't have the answers. And one of the things that one of the things we've maintained is that what we know is that we don't know. We don't know everything and are looking for the community to reach out to and reach back to help give us some insight on what they would like to see. But when it comes to veterans especially, obviously there's a significant need. And what we need to look at and consider is that, as a perfect example, I myself play wheelchair basketball. And on our wheelchair basketball team, we have three veterans. Without our veterans, we don't have a team, and without the civilians competing along with the veterans, they don't have a team. So it's really a nice complement for the two groups to come together as one, as opposed to, once again, in many instances, segregating veterans with disabilities versus civilians with disabilities. We need to be a cohesive group in order to create a successful model.
Now, Damien, you're working to create this Ability Center in Milwaukee County. Where are you now, and what are the next steps?
We are hoping to have land confirmed of where we will build the site by the end of the year. Certainly, you can build an accessible or universally designed facility anywhere, but if it's not in an accessible location to actually get to via transportation, primarily public transportation, then you're not meeting the mission. So finding that space in Milwaukee County isn't necessarily easy, but we hope to have that answer in the next year and be able to break ground within the next two and be open within the next three, somewhere around the summer or fall of 2018.
And this is a private entity, nonprofit, public-private partnership. How does that all work?
It's a nonprofit entity at this point, hoping to collaborate and work with both the Milwaukee Regional Medical Center as well as Milwaukee County to bring this asset to the community. You know, a lot of times, as Jason was explaining, these bring a significant economic impact to a community, and a lot of times a community will throw tax dollars or push tax dollars towards a project like this, and even the community might lead it on its own. We're not looking for anything in that space, just the acceptance of building such a facility in the area.
Well, Damien, thanks for joining us. Hope we can talk to you on opening day.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
And Jason Clement, thanks to you as well.
I appreciate it. Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Damien Bookman, founder and executive director of the Ability Center, and Jason Clement, founder and COO of the Sports Facility Advisory.